This is episode 423, dated Friday, August 1st, 2025.
You are listening to the In Perspective weekly podcast with Bob Branco and Peter O'Toole.
Hi, everyone, and welcome once again to In Perspective. I'm Bob Branco. Good to be here today. This is episode 423, dated Friday, August 1st, 2025. Allow me to introduce our good friend, colleague, and co-host for today's show, Peter O'Toole. Peter, what's happening?
Good afternoon, Bob and audience. It's a typical summer day in Coos Bay, which means it's about 60 degrees. The sun's out. There's a breeze, and we are very happy with this weather.
We are cloudy, had a little rain earlier today. I think the sun might have peaked a couple times. It's in the 70s, so we're a little cooler than it has been for a while, but we'll welcome it, that's for sure. Before we continue, let me thank those people who make it possible for In Perspective to be made available to the general public. We start out with Raymond Gay, our producer. Thank you for what you do. Also, the media outlets, thank you for airing us when you do. It's much appreciated. And finally, Jacqueline Sylvia from JS Web Solutions. Thank you for archiving our shows on my website. All you need to do to find those archives is go to www.brancoevents.com. Arrow down until you get to In Perspective Podcasts. Click on those, and you will see most of our archives from latest to earliest.
Merci, Jackie.
I want to say hi to a listener, Terry Winnott. Terry, thank you very much for writing about our show. We appreciate that. And we encourage other listeners to write to us as well with their questions and comments. And we are live streamed, so those people who are listening on live stream may want to write us by hearing our email address for the show. That's bobbranco93@gmail.com. That's bobbranco93@gmail.com if you want to send us a letter about In Perspective. I also want to say hi to Trish, our host for today's show and our facilitator, and Brad for being our streamer for today's show.
Bob, before we introduce the guest, I also want to thank Alice Massa for her nice comments about the show that I got. We appreciate your regular listenership and your kind words.
Thank you, Alice. That's Alice from Be My Eye, Behind Our Eyes. Be My Eyes is a technical device. Alice Massa from Behind Our Eyes, thank you very much for your thoughtful comments about our program. We appreciate that, too. Back again for another appearance. We just had her on several weeks back. Allison Weinman, Dr. Allison Weinman, infectious disease specialist and physician consultant. By popular demand, welcome back, Allison.
Thank you so much. It's such a pleasure to be back.
So, I'm sure that you have other information to offer us that we didn't have time for in May. You can talk about that right away, or you could just fill us in, give us a little brief summary of what you did speak of the last time you were on the show.
Well, last time I think we spoke quite a bit about COVID, and I think we spoke some about vaccines. So I'm happy to speak about whatever you'd like right now. I think one of the things that's topical is sort of what's happening in healthcare right now, with the new administration and changes to healthcare and what that may look like in the future. Be happy to talk about that and what that means for vaccines. I think that's a good discussion to have.
All right. So, well,
before we do that, why don't you talk a little about what the kind of work you actually do and what you've been working on most recently?
Well, most recently I've been doing some work for the visually impaired community. Doing some consulting and, otherwise sort of keeping very busy on some various boards.
When you say working for the visually impaired community, what does that mean?
I'm working with leader dogs and also, with the agency for the blind and visually impaired in Michigan.
And what kind of work are you doing for both groups?
I'm really doing sort of consulting work. They have some task forces that are looking at obstacles to getting access to healthcare for the visually impaired community, and also some educational opportunities just for general healthcare issues.
And
I'm assuming.
Go ahead.
I'm assuming that Medicaid is a major player in this because a lot of people with disabilities, whether blind or otherwise disabled, and based on income, of course, and lack of employment in some cases, Medicaid plays a major role. Do you deal with the Medicaid piece at all?
Not currently, but certainly all nonprofit healthcare systems that are affiliated and accredited with the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid, are reimbursed by those centers. And when Medicaid was expanded, it really helped the individual patient. It helps the hospital, helps the general population, and it helps keep costs down. So I am quite apprehensive about what's going to happen with the Medicaid cuts that are looming.
Yeah, let's go back to the direction that we were going to go in before I sidetracked it. As you said, last time we talked a lot about COVID and the lessons to be learned through that experience. And we began to talk about, as I remember, sort of the new direction that we might be going in under the new administration Robert Kennedy Jr.
Yes.
So talk about what you're noticing that's different. What are you happy about? What are you not so happy about? Sort of give us a sense of where you're at these days.
Okay. I want to be clear that I don't represent anybody's views but my own. But, healthcare, I think, is in a big crisis right now. And I think one of the things that's always made America so strong in healthcare is that we had wonderful research and scientists. And we have the National Institutes of Health and other organizations that provide a lot of grant money for very important research. And very large cuts have been made to all of those programs. And research, for those of you who are, I'm sure there's some of you that are very familiar, some of you less familiar, research is not something you can stop and start. And some studies go on for many, many years, and they can't be just interrupted. And we're talking about all kinds of studies for Alzheimer's prevention, for women's health, for the disabled, for the visually impaired community, for cancer research. So those scientists and researchers that are doing all kinds of exciting new research have sort of been ground to a halt in many cases. And anything that has the name diversity, equity, inclusion, disability, anything that's a bit different has really been either shut down entirely or they've lost a lot of people. And I think a lot of my colleagues who do both clinical care and research are thinking about their careers very seriously about what to do about that because they've lost their grant money. And often grant money supports salaries. That's how academic hospitals work, where a lot of this research is done. And what happens then is that people then say, well, I could probably get a better job if I leave the country. And I think America is going to see a large brain drain, and I think that's already started. I know many people have left the country, looking to have better research opportunities elsewhere. And that's a great shame. And that coupled with the difficulties with university funding and so on that's being looked at for, maybe curtailing academic research in certain areas, make me very apprehensive about the future of healthcare in America.
And I think, I realize you speak for yourself and nobody else. Senator Kenny, it is Secretary Kennedy, is not very happy with, as I understand it, sort of the way, drugs are used or not used, the vaccines, the way they're used or not used, the way research is being done. He thinks that the kind of research that's being done is not helping matters. Other things over other things. It's clear you're not happy with him, but I guess where do we go from here?
Well, I think, I want to make several points first, if you don't mind, about him.
Sure.
One is that he is not a medical doctor. He is not scientifically trained, and he has surrounded himself with people that are not scientists or doctors or have special training in interpreting data and other things. And many of the statements he made are frankly inaccurate. And, for example, thimerosal vaccines causing autism. This has been disproven in multiple studies in the past. and money has already been spent on this. That question has been asked and answered multiple times in good, valid studies. And I don't think we need to spend more money going back and reinventing the wheel for something that has been scientifically disproven. Also, some of the facts that he cites are, he's read a paper and he's taken the raw data and maybe made a conclusion from that, but it shows he doesn't know how to interpret the data and has not read the whole paper thoroughly. And as well as that, what scares me is it doesn't matter if somebody who's in charge has limited training in that area. That's all fine, as long as you surround yourself with smart people that know what they're talking about. And what's happened is that he has now disbanded the Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices, who advises the CDC. They look at new vaccines, they look at safety, they look at efficacy, and they make vaccine recommendations for the community. And what happens is then a few months later, and that those meetings are very transparent, they're open to the public, anybody can attend them, and they have experts on their committee. They used to have experts on the committee that would look at all this data in great detail. They'd meet for several days, people could call in or just listen in. And then what happened after that, the vaccines recommendations, usually from that committee, were accepted by the CDC, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. And then a few months later, the insurance companies would then, if they adopted a new vaccine or made a new recommendation for scheduling, then the insurance companies would pay for that vaccine. So what's happening is that we're sort of taking retrograde steps with these committees either being abandoned altogether or replaced with people that do not have scientific knowledge, do not have vaccine expertise, do not have expertise in these very important areas of public health for the entire American population. And that's reflected in the recommendations that are coming out. For example, pregnant women are, you know, the recommendation is from Kennedy is that they don't need COVID vaccine. It has been very well established in many studies that pregnant women do badly if they have COVID and they're not immunized, as do, and they have poor fetal outcomes as well. So again, we're just kind of going back and reinventing the science, and populations that need to be protected against COVID are not being considered. And I don't quite understand how it's been twisted the way it's been twisted, but there are many, many people and associations like the American Academy of Pediatrics, the Infectious Disease Society of America, the Society of Healthcare and Epidemiology of America. These are big organizations that are well represented by experts that are all condemning those recommendations that are coming out without expert advice. And I think that puts the country in a very frightening position, because we look to the CDC, we look to these organizations to give us scientifically recommended data on vaccines, and also medication safety like the FDA. So to go back and say these vaccines are not safe or effective, that has been extensively studied and looked at by experts in the area. So it seems...
Go ahead.
Sorry. No, go ahead.
I was going to say, what in your opinion, Dr. Weinman, is Mr. Kennedy's agenda? What is the basis for what he's doing?
I think he has a very long history of being a vaccine doubter, and he has spread a lot of misinformation over the years, for example, about vaccines causing autism, childhood vaccines, again, disproven in multiple scientifically done studies. And I think his agenda is that he believes in certain theories that are not scientific, and no matter how much science is thrown at him, he has chosen not to believe them, and then says, well, let's go and do a study about autism and thimerosal and vaccines. It's been done. It's been done and done and done, and it is scientific fact. So I'm not sure, I can't speak for what his agenda is, but it is frightening to have somebody, again, it's fine to have somebody who's not highly experienced, but it's really important that they surround themselves with experts, and the experts seem to be falling away. So I think, you know, in answer to your question, long-winded way of saying, you know, what are you happy with? I think that the way that this turns around, and the only way this turns around, is if these big societies of experts, of doctors, of the American Medical Association continue to protest and write statements, and that the American public says, this is ridiculous. I want to be able to have access to vaccines. We've got a multi-state outbreak of measles. Why do we have that? Because it's an unimmunized population. And the reason for that is people believe or have bought into or are frightened by stuff that's coming out from the government, and so children are under-immunized. And that's frightening. People die because of that. It's not a small thing.
I think a big part of this is the direct result of some of the stories that came out during COVID. People had such a phobia about the vaccine. I've heard all kind of reasons why people were reluctant to take the COVID vaccines. Either they were going to be sterile, they were going to die of heart failure. I think that was one of them. There were several other reasons why people refused to take the vaccine. They thought it would kill people more than it would help people. This was a broad opinion all over the country, Dr. Wyman, whether we liked it or not.
Yes.
I'm lucky. I took two Moderna shots. I took one booster shot. I am fine. I figured I would rather do that than run the risk of catching. I did catch COVID anyway back in 2022 after I was vaccinated.
Yes. It doesn't prevent,
but I'm glad I took the vaccines. Right. But you'd be amazed at all of the phobia out there over the vaccine.
Yeah. Well, I was one of the people who was, we're very involved in the vaccine rollout. And I have to say the science was very carefully looked at by the Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices. And I just want to emphasize that these mRNA vaccines, these so-called new vaccines, are not new. And I think we talked about that a little bit last time. They've been used in cancer drugs for about a decade before. So this was not new technology. Now, of course, when any new drug or vaccine appears on the market, it has to be closely monitored, even though it's very extensively studied beforehand, because sometimes unusual side effects occur, and that is the case. But what happened is that those vaccines really did change the course of the pandemic because it established herd immunity. So people either had natural COVID and either got very sick or died or were hospitalized, if you remember in the beginning waves of the epidemic. And then when the vaccine became available, that's really what changed things around. So most people were immunized one way or the other. And yes, there was a lot of vaccine hesitancy. And there were a lot of us on the front lines saying, hey, I just got my COVID shot. These are the reasons why, you know, you shouldn't be overly concerned. But vaccine hesitancy predates COVID by quite a long way. There have been concerns about really every vaccine. In fact, I think one of the last publicly really enthusiastically embraced vaccines was for polio back in the 50s. You know, people lined up so their kids didn't get polio. And guess what? Their kids didn't get polio because they got vaccinated. So, you know, but there's been a long history of vaccine hesitancy and lots of mythology around vaccines. And it's just like anything you take, penicillin, aspirin, there are side effects to anything you take. And everything in medicine is a risk-benefit ratio, right? What are the risks? What are the benefits? Even though there's some risk to everything, the benefits of vaccination clearly outweigh the risks in every situation in which a vaccine is licensed and approved. And that's what the Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices looks at all that data before they say, go ahead and do this vaccine. And I was present at the calls that they did for each vaccine as it became available for COVID. And they looked at all the data that was available. And it was very thoughtfully researched and very thoughtfully reviewed before those vaccines were released. So, yep. There are some side effects. There are side effects to everything. But again, it's all about risk benefit and who are you protecting in the community. So vaccines are not very helpful unless you get most people immunized because we're relying on the so-called herd immunity because some people, for medical reasons, cannot receive certain vaccines. For example, the measles, mumps, and rubella vaccine, the MMR, that is a live vaccine. So if you're pregnant, you can't get that vaccine, or if you have certain conditions that suppress your immune system, it's not safe to get that vaccine. So we're getting immunized not just for ourselves, but to protect those small pockets of individuals who are unable to get vaccinated because of a medical reason. And the more of us that get immunized, we protect the general community. So there's less, for example, measles circulating in the community, and the deaths will be less because people are immunized and protecting those really susceptible populations that cannot be immunized for certain things.
So, doctor, one of the things that that's been mystifying to me is everything that you're saying, of course, is true. The problem is that there is a mistrust of institutions and of quote unquote experts that has taken over our country. And,
yes.
And the research has sort of flipped on its head. So I know there are people in parts of the country who believe not that COVID saved lives, but that it took lives, that people died specifically because of the vaccine. Now, I understand that people, unfortunately, as you said, there are consequences and there are downsides, and some people, I'm sure, did die of related to the vaccine, very, very small numbers. But some people, you know, their argument is that, you know, the vaccine killed lots and lots of people. And just to tell you how this plays out where I am, which is a rural county here in Oregon, a year and a half ago, I had a stent put in my heart because I had heart issues. And, I can't tell how many people said to me, did you have a COVID vaccine? And I said, yeah. And they said, well, that's because the heart problem you're having is because of the vaccine you took. And I don't know how to respond to that, because from the first place, I think there was some research that said if you had certain heart conditions, vaccines was not warranted. But I did take the vaccines. I'm grateful I did. But there are people who really have these beliefs and have a mistrust of science, mistrust of experts. And how do you sort of take on that kind of belief system?
Yeah, it's really difficult, isn't it? So I can tell you that one of the strongest predictors of who gets vaccinated is if their physician that they know and trust strongly recommends it. The chance of that person getting vaccinated is extremely high. And so I hate to say it, but, you know, we do a lot of public health education. We try and do that. The CDC was supporting that. Now we don't have these big institutions being able to support the science. And so we're even further behind the eight ball. And I think more and more people do not know who to turn to anymore. I think at the moment, the people that I would turn to is I still look to those experts, but I'm really wary of things that come out of the government, because I think a lot of that is not correct information. So I think, again, people need to turn with their own individual health conditions to weigh out whether a vaccine is appropriate for them. Their doctor is the person to give them the best possible recommendations. And I think people, I agree with you, there's a general distrust of experts and, you know, just across the board in every area. But I think people generally have a relationship with their doctor and trust their doctor because their doctor knows their own health the best. And I think in the end, that's one of the best resources that people have. Almost everybody who can afford it now will have a primary care doctor. And that person hopefully will be educated and be looking at good science to back up the recommendations for an individual patient.
The flip side to that is, at least where I am, again, in a rural county in Oregon.
Yes. Yes.
There are not that many doctors who want to be here for any number of reasons. And, you don't have that long-term relationship with a doctor. I was really fortunate to get a doctor at all as primary care. Because my wife, you know, sort of pleaded him to take me on because there are people, you know, there was nobody else available.
Right. And I think that's going to be exacerbated because these Medicaid cuts are going to hurt rural communities the most. So if you're a small struggling hospital in a rural community and you get funding cut through Medicaid, a lot of hospitals are going to have to simply close their doors. And that's already starting to happen. And then rural communities will not have access to healthcare. So that's another disparity. That is really a frightening disparity. And there are many reasons why people don't want to go practice in rural areas, you know, for lifestyle, all different kinds of reasons that people put forward. But I think that's going to be the consequence, that people are going to have a lot harder time than they have had finding a doctor who will stick with them, finding a hospital that can take care of them. That's going to be a big problem in upcoming as soon as these Medicaid cuts become effective. And the beds that there are going to end up getting clogged up with folks that, for example, an elderly person comes in and they need to go to a nursing home. Well, hospitals won't do unsafe discharges. Good luck trying to find a nursing home that accepts Medicaid. It's already hard now. But so those patients, they can't go anywhere. They just sit in the hospital bed. Hospitals lose money on those patients. Not that it's about the money. Even not-for-profits lose money. And you can't get patients in that need those beds. So there's this backlog, and it's going to be exacerbated when Medicaid is cut.
And when are those cuts supposed to begin? I think it's not until the end of next year is when the real action is going to happen after the elections.
Yeah, but I think lots of like funding cuts are already affecting hospitals, like all these funding cuts to grants. So a lot of people's salaries are grant supported for research grants. And so those folks are already looking for other jobs or moving around. And hospitals run a non-for-profit hospital runs a tight margin. And if you suddenly, a large swath of your population, or even a quarter of your population, or a tenth of your population is Medicaid, you rely on every dollar. And I know, you know, there's lots of issues about healthcare and dollars. And I, you know, I appreciate all those problems that already exist. But now you put another problem onto hospitals, and there's only so much hospitals can absorb. They're already lean. They've cut staff. They've cut resources. They've, you know, increased waiting times, et cetera, et cetera. And I'm sure we've all been subjected to some of that. But I think it's only going to get worse when these cuts come through. I'm very apprehensive, and I think most physicians are apprehensive about what's going to happen to hospital care, which is already, as we know, inequitable in geography and money and everything else. What's going to happen, and how are these beds going to get freed up?
It is a challenge, and I guess, you know, and I know what you're talking about, because the hospitals that are around here are having trouble holding on to their doctors. You know, if you have cancer, for example, and you are, you know, trying to get good care for your cancer, and you don't have a long-term, doctor to sort of oncologist to sort of help you go through the process, because they keep changing every 6 months. And so you don't develop that relationship, and you are then more likely to get your medical advice from other sources, which is things like the internet. I'm beginning to wonder, and I wonder what your take on this is how the role of faith leaders, the ministers, the rabbis, the imams, and what role they might play. Cause I think they might become more and more important in this thing until we can turn things around.
Yeah. I know at least in Detroit, during the COVID pandemic, we really reached out to all those faith leaders, and I have to say they absolutely stepped up. And there are a lot of, you know, Detroit is a fairly religious city. The ministers, the imams, the rabbis, they really helped with vaccine drives, education to their, you know, to their populations. And they were extremely helpful and educated. And I think you're right. I think they have an important role to play, just as teachers do, just as, you know, what people learn in school. And I agree with you. It's really a big problem. I wish I had the answer for what it would be. But also in rural populations, how do you reach out to them? Just as you pointed out, how do you make it more attractive for somebody to go to a rural population who's in a cancer specialist? How do you do that? How do you make sure that a cancer specialist operating in a rural population has enough support in a hospital? You know, can that, if I'm a cancer specialist and I set up practice in your rural community, if my patient needs chemotherapy, you've got to go to a center that is expert in administering chemotherapy. Does that exist in rural communities? And I think that rural communities are traditionally underserved. And they are trying to attract, they have been trying for a long time to attract physicians. But as more and more of these smaller centers close, especially in rural communities, I worry about that. I worry about rural communities having access to care. It's really going to be an increasing problem. And I don't want to say everybody just moved to the city, because that's clearly not viable. But often it's going to turn out that the bigger hospital systems that can survive these shortages are probably going to be located in cities. And I don't know where that puts the rural population. And these things should have been thought of and considered, because it is going to disproportionately affect rural populations, indigent populations, people of color, people who are of disability, for example, as well. And as you pointed out, many folks with disability are in a very limited income. And unfortunately, this population is going to be affected by all these cuts.
Another thing that's common is I know people who've gone to hospitals, have stayed to the point where the doctors almost have to release them right after their procedures. And the most common reason that I'm hearing for this, Dr. Weinman, is their insurance won't cover their extended stays. Their insurance won't fund them, so the doctor has to release the patient prior to when he really would want to release the patient.
Yeah, there is a lot of pressure. So the way hospitals are reimbursed is sort of confusing, and I don't pretend to know the answers to that, but it is confusing, and there is pressure, because there's always pressure on beds. And as you probably know, if anybody in the audience has visited an emergency room recently, you're probably going to wait 8-9 hours if you don't have anything immediately life-threatening, or you might spend a few nights in the emergency room because there's simply no bed to put you in. And those waits are going to get longer and longer. And emergency rooms aren't really set up to provide care in the same way an inpatient setting is. So there's problems all along the way. And I think that, you know, really before any of these cuts should happen or should take place, people need to rise up and say, this is not okay. I mean, I think I've already said I am a proponent of nationalized health. That's not going to happen anytime soon. But I think that we really have disproportionate health care in this country. It's not fair. It's not equitable. And it's going to get worse because who needs Medicaid? The people who are the least privileged need Medicaid. And you cut people off from Medicaid, they haven't got any place else to go. And so they're going to crowd the emergency rooms. They're going to crowd everywhere else. And just like everybody who has an urgent health care need, emergency rooms can't turn people away. But then you've got to send somebody somewhere. And so if there's no beds, that becomes another problem.
So you talked about some consulting work you're doing for visually impaired people. How does all this conversation tie into the work you're currently doing?
Well, I'm mainly doing work getting people access to care because one of the issues that I faced, even as a physician, was getting access to care when I lost vision. So I found there was a general ignorance around what do people need who are visually impaired. And for example, I had some great care with ophthalmology, wonderful care. But ophthalmologists are surgeons, and if they can't fix you, then you're sort of left. And so I sort of got this backhand, and you know, if you're a novice to the visually impaired community, you don't know about all the resources that are out there. So it's kind of, and this is sort of across the country, very variable what facilities, what agencies are available to assist you. And so I ended up being referred to a low vision clinic, kind of as an offhanded, well, I can't really help you. Maybe you could go to a low vision clinic. And when I asked what a low vision clinic could do, I said, well, I haven't really been to the low vision clinic, so I don't really know, but I think they might help with whatever vision you've got left. And going to that low vision, and if I hadn't been, you know, so in need of services, I probably would have said, well, they weren't very enthusiastic about that, so they don't think it's important. I probably won't go. And hearing from the ophthalmologist's point of view, patients don't want to go to a place called a low vision clinic because sometimes we don't want to accept that, in fact, we do have low vision and we need assistance. And it's through those low vision clinics and other centers like Leader Dogs, et cetera, that people learn about various things around the community that are available to them and other resources that are available to them. Because it's actually really hard. And some states have very, very few resources. We're lucky in Michigan. We have Leader Dogs, which is in, you know, is in Michigan and attracts people from all over the country and all over the world. But there are only a few centers like that in the United States. So again, if you live in rural America or you live in a state that doesn't have good services for the visually impaired, it is hard for people to get hooked up. And I'd be really interested to hear back from the audience about all kinds of problems that they've encountered because you really have to become your own advocate. And if you don't have somebody to help you advocate for yourself, it's difficult to get what you need.
Well, speaking of the audience, it's almost time for us to turn our program over to our audience. You are listening to In Perspective. Our guest is Dr. Allison Weinman, infectious disease specialist and physician consultant. So let me turn it over to Trish just to find out if anybody has their hand raised. Maybe somebody would like to ask Dr. Weinman some questions or comment on the discussion.
Okay, we actually have two hands raised, and the first is Brian Coppola.
Brian from Massachusetts, yes. Welcome. Brian, you might be muted.
Need to unmute, Brian.
If you're on the phone, it's star 6. If you're on a computer, it's either Alt-Y or Alt-A, depending on what kind of computer you're using. Well, not Alt-Y, I'm sorry. Alt-A.
Okay, Brian. Can you hear me now?
Yes, yeah. Brian, go right ahead. What can I do for you? Or what can we do
for you? Okay. Well, in hearing all of this, okay, I get the sense here that Kennedy and Trump are doing things very, 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 very irresponsible. They're trying to play God, but they're not God. And I really believe that by what they're doing, they want people to die. And they want the poor to die. And I think people, okay, especially the classes of 2026, 2027 and beyond need to be learning more important stuff in school, like history, civics, government, and not sex change operations. You need to know this stuff because you need to know about the voting and the political system to vote, to get these people who are doing this misinformation voted out and new people in that are doing the right thing.
Dr. Weinman?
Yeah, Brian, I think that's great advice. I think we often forget that we still are America. We have a vote. Now, whichever way you voted last time, there's always ways to rectify things. If you are not happy with the current situation, there will be a new election at some point. There'll be a midterm election. And in the meantime, we all have voices. Even if we have visual disabilities, call your senators, write to your senators, protest, and let people know that. So many people have been participating in a lot of these protests that are across the country, you know, protesting cuts to public health, et cetera, et cetera. And I think, you know, protests only go so far, but I do think that if a nationwide protest is called for personally, I think that it's a good thing. I think body count, I know that sounds awful, but, you know, the more people that show up, that's what makes TV crews broadcast the news, is that this is a protest with a large number of people. So if you don't agree with what's going on, we still have the right to protest, to peacefully protest. And I would add peacefully. I think it's very important that people let their voices be heard.
Doctor.
May I say one more thing?
Yes.
Before I finish again. Yeah. The thing is, I think it is important too that these rehabilitation centers, including job market prep programs for the visually impaired or any disability, start teaching about the right to vote advocacy, the importance of it as part of a resource class. Because absent teaching yet that stuff as part of the curriculum, in my opinion, I would consider it safe if you're not gonna.
Well, thank you, Brian. Very, Dr. very Hunt, thoughtful comments. Go ahead.
I know we have another hand up, but I want to ask you your thoughts about nonviolent protest. Connected me, and I forget the gentleman's name who was assassinated. The head of a health insurance company.
Yes.
Has caused, you know, a while back some controversy. And a lot of people were sort of celebrating that assassination. And obviously I don't want anybody shot dead. I mean, you know, that's totally inappropriate, but there's a lot of anger against healthcare companies. And I don't know how you would, which is all connected to what we're talking about here. How do you address something like that?
It is. And I've got to say, you know, I totally for peaceful protests, peaceful, you know, but that United Healthcare CEO, I think he was, if I'm not mistaken. I think there, when you deal with insurance companies on an individual basis, which we frequently have to do because claims are denied all the time, despite what a physician recommends for an individual patient. And often the person on the other end of the line who's denying the claim is not an expert. It's not an expert in your field, not even a physician often. It's usually a clerk of some kind who may not even have a college degree. And then you have to take time out of your day and the patient's day to call them and then try and get onto what's called a peer review person in these instances. The peer review person may be somebody who's completely outside your specialty and giving you advice. And so that is very frustrating, right? So I wouldn't presume to give advice to a psychiatrist if they were doing something for their patient, because I'm not a psychiatrist. But to have a psychiatrist tell me that what I'm doing in infectious diseases is not in the best interest of my patient, which really means we don't want to pay for it. I don't really have a clue if it's in the best interest of your patient or not. That's a problem. And so that system, I agree with you, is also broken. And, you know, I've worked in Australia. They have nationalized health. I think there are disadvantages to nationalized health, but overall, everybody has equal access to basic care. And I think that's really important. I think the states are a very long way away from doing that. I thought we were moving towards it at one time, but I think the further away we get from that model, which seems to be the one that works the best in most other countries, the more I think it's just going to continue to disintegrate. And I'm not defending insurance companies. I think there's a lot of you know, people make a lot of money in insurance companies, especially the higher ups, the executives. And I can understand the anger against that CEO. I don't condone his killing, but I think there is a lot of anger. And all you have to do is deal with one insurance company and you just want to rip your hair out, let alone the patient. The poor patient is stuck in the middle.
Yeah. Yeah. A lot more to be said about that. Who's our next?
Thank you, Brian.
Okay. So just so you know, we actually have three hands up now.
No,
so
all right. Let's do it.
The next one is going to be Pam Coffey, followed by Janine, and then we have a third one after that.
Pam, okay. You're next.
Okay. And my apologies for the background noise. We are in the middle of a thunderstorm here.
I hear no noise, so you're
well,
all right.
Not yet. Not yet. It'll happen. And I've got as many doors shut to the outside as I can. But something you said earlier really resonated with me. And that was, you know, we need to listen to the people who really are the experts. And of course, part of the problem is, and I first became aware of this near the beginning of COVID. There was this little group of so-called doctors. I would describe them as rogue doctors. They supposedly were doctors, but they called their little group something like frontline doctors.
Yes. I'm very familiar with them, yes.
Very familiar with those, I bet. Well, the thing is, a lot of people thought, oh, these are on the front line. They really know what they're talking about. Well, I'm not a scientist. I don't even pretend to be a scientist. I have a bachelor's in psychology, but that doesn't make me a scientist. And even I knew, wait a minute. These so-called doctors that supposedly worked in emergency rooms, and all of a sudden they're against vaccines. They're promoting, oh, whatever that drug was you give animals for.
Yes.
Yeah. And, you know, giving it to people. Well, that's a good way to kill a person. Give them a horse vaccine. Horses weigh a lot more. They're a lot larger than people are.
Yes.
And it was just, it was just scary stuff. A lot of people bought into it because they thought these people were the expert, these so-called frontline doctors. And I think sadly, not only are we as a nation, as a society, becoming skeptical of quote, experts, unquote. We are becoming skeptical of education as a whole, which to me is very frightening, very, very scary.
I completely agree with you. And I'm very familiar with that group. And the trouble is that you're right. People don't know who the experts are anymore. That group of physicians was a fringe group of physicians.
Yes. Yes, they were
not mainstream. Most of the papers that they published were retracted or withdrawn because of scientific fraud or inaccuracies. Mm-hmm. And many of those people have actually lost their medical licenses over the harm they did in COVID.
Yeah. From what I understand. In fact, one of them, it's a good thing I don't remember her name, but she got into a lot of trouble elsewhere, not only medically, but she was one of the ones that was at the Capitol on January the 6th or whatever day it was of 21. And she got herself into a whole lot of trouble. I think she ended up going to prison, but.
Yeah. No, I think you're right. I think it's so hard now for the general population to figure out who's an expert. And that's why if they have someone they have a relationship with, that person would be the good frontline person. And then I used to refer people to the CDC, to the NIH, because that was reliable scientific data.
Gotcha.
But now.
It's not like that now.
No, it's hard to know what to believe now because some of the things that they're coming out with is not accurate either.
You know what part of the problem is? You know what part of the reason for this is? The media.
And the social scene, the social media scene, right?
Social media.
Mm-hmm. You see something on Instagram, it looks like it's real.
That's part of the reason I'm not on Instagram.
Well, Pam, thank you very much for your input. It's much appreciated.
Doctor, a quick
thank
question.
You. Great.
Hydrochlorocene, that whatever the name of that thing was that was supposed to be
hydrochloroquine and ivermectin. Those were the two. Probably disproven.
There was a study that came out that I read about, and I've never heard it about since, that they did this. They used that in India as the primary care, and it was a great success. So did you hear anything about that? And how was the research done?
Yeah, I'm not familiar with that particular study, but there were several studies that came out about ivermectin and hydrochloroquine, which did look theoretically promising at the beginning. So I understand why people were using those drugs. And in fact, a lot of academic medical centers at the very beginning of COVID, when we had nothing else, we started doing some of those things too. And then we realized we were harming patients, and the studies were pretty consistent and showed that those drugs harm people and in fact can be life threatening to people. So
we have two hands, so I would like to get to them.
Yeah, thank you, sure. Doctor. Apologies, but I really.
Oh, no, no worries. Yeah.
Go ahead, Trish. Who's next?
Next we have Janine, who will be followed by Stacy Smith.
All right, Janine.
Hello.
Welcome.
Hi, Janine.
Okay. Yes. Hi. My question is twofold. I anticipate that my doctor will tell me to get a COVID shot. And are they going to be available, and will they be of the same quality as prior years?
Such a good question. So one of the things that the Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices did was decide not only the safety and efficacy of vaccines based on data, but also make recommendations about what the formulation should be in each vaccine. So the COVID vaccine, as you know, changed several times because there were different strains of COVID going around, just like the flu vaccine changes every year.
Mm-hmm. The
folks giving input into that, those committees were not operational. So honestly, I don't know about what the availability of COVID vaccine will be. I assume there'll be enough. It may be that several populations will have to pay for it out of pocket who may not have had to do so before. For example, Kennedy wants to take it off the children's schedule. Now I think a lot of parents of children are going to want their kids to be vaccinated, not only to protect their kids, and kids in general did not get severe COVID, but there were plenty of pediatric deaths, if we remember back to the old days of COVID, but also it's who those kids are going to bring COVID to. And so children, young children especially, spread COVID to people in their families that may not be able to get a COVID vaccine for various reasons, etc. So I honestly don't know what the availability would be. I can just tell you that I'm hopeful there'll be enough vaccine present. I'm worried that people making those decisions, again, about the contents of the vaccine are not going to be the right people in the right place. So I'm hopeful it'll still be whatever. Most of the COVID vaccines have all covered certain prevalent strains. So my current recommendation is, you know, in the fall, when you get your flu shot, you should also get your COVID shot as a booster.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Thanks for your question.
Thank you, Jenny. All right, so we have
next
one
we
more.
Have Stacy, and then Nora. So Stacy.
All right, Stacy. Go ahead.
If there is a problem with Medicaid, what would you suggest we do if we get cut off? I mean, if there's a widespread problem, you know, in the future.
Right. Well, that is a really good question, and I wish I knew the answer to that, because the people who are on Medicaid are really the least privileged of our population in many ways, right? So to get on Medicaid, you have to have a low income. And it's not just people who are not working, it's people who are disabled, people who work maybe two jobs but still are on Medicaid because they work a low wage job. So I think those are all questions that should have been considered by Congress and the administration before they propose these very big cuts to Medicaid that are coming. And who's benefiting from it? As far as we know, the elite classes of people who are extremely rich. And personally, I don't think that's fair or equitable. And I don't know who's going to take up the burden. I suspect what's going to happen is that somebody's going to have to pay healthcare expenses, and it will probably come back to the people who have some insurance. Things are going to get more expensive for people that have insurance to help cover the people of Medicaid, whereas before the government paid for it, which was us too, but it was all in an organized way so that people didn't have to panic. So I guess the only piece of really good news is if you're on Medicaid, you can always get care in an emergency room unless they change those regulations. So you can always get care, but the question is, what will happen if you need admission to a hospital and that hospital can't afford to take Medicaid patients or has to limit them, or there are no beds because people waiting for nursing homes, et cetera, who only have Medicaid can't, you know, go through the system. And Medicaid's not the only people, by the way, who block up the system. There are many other system problems, but this Medicaid is known to be a problem. Because you can't discharge an unsafe setting if you can't find a nursing home that will take Medicaid, I don't know what those people are going to do. I wish I had a better answer for you. I honestly do, but I'm worried.
So, yeah, Doctor, worried one of the things that came up when we had this debate over when the ACA was being discussed is the basic response from folks who thought the American ACA, Obamacare, was, hey, doctors need to provide free health care to folks who need it. You know, why is it the government's responsibility to do this when, you know, when doctors are making lots, and this was the argument, lots and lots of money, they should be giving free health care to folks who really need it. And I'm going to give you my answer to that question. I'm curious to know what yours is. My stepmom, dad was a doctor, and practiced medicine through the Depression. And, he talked about, he did a lot of that, gave free healthcare and accepted like chickens for payment and so on and so forth. The problem was, and a lot of doctors were doing that, it wasn't enough.
Yeah.
It wasn't enough. So, you know, this idea that doctors, you know, were just need to, you know, do more good work, I'm not sure it's going to solve that particular problem either.
Yeah, I agree with you. I think that, well, certainly in academic centers, so I'm talking about big medical, nonprofit medical centers, you know, doctors don't get paid a lot of money. It's pretty lean. I'm not saying doctors don't make a good income. Please don't make me, you know, say that. I'm not saying that or implying that. I think that there are a lot of inequities in the payment system, even in academic centers. I think nurses are severely underpaid. Social workers, severely underpaid. That's another podcast, another discussion. But if you're in private practice, for example, you still have to make some money to keep your doors open so you can help people. So it's all very well to say, well, doctors just need to work longer, harder. There are a lot of requirements of people to fill out documentation, which takes hours more than it used to. A lot of time to shorten patient visits so that they don't have time to see patients. So there's a lot of business pressure. You still need money to keep your doors open. And, you know, we all know about people who took chickens in the Depression, all kinds of things. And that's great. But in the end, you have to keep your doors open somehow. You've got to pay the electricity. You've got to pay the rent. You've got to pay everything in order to help the vast majority of people. So I think the answer can't be people just need to volunteer their time and give up their time, because they've got to feed their families too and keep the lights on at their place.
We have about 4 minutes to go, and I do want to get to Nora.
Sure.
So Nora, you're next. Welcome to In Perspective.
Well, thank you. Glad to be here. And anyway, the reason I raised my hand is because I wanted to let you know that in the very beginning of a pandemic, Trump mentioned some kind of a meditation for somebody to take, and it was, and somebody took that, and actually it was the coil something that actually is supposed to be a fish tank cleaner, and he died from taking that. And some people may have thought that President Trump said the right thing, but he probably matured. Now that was terrible. So
I heard about that, I think.
Yeah, it was so terrible, and it's a shame that some people misunderstood the president or
nothing happening along the line. And another thing, the reason I don't get any booster shots for COVID, because I don't want anything harmful to happen to me. So I just had one COVID shot from Johnson & Johnson, and that's it. I just stay the way I am.
Yeah, again, thank you for your question and for calling in. I think, you know, the best thing, you know, we all know that the immunity, the protectiveness against COVID, the vaccine and all, and a lot of vaccines wanes. So if you just got one shot and it was a couple of years ago, truthfully, you're probably not covered now. So I would recommend that if you have a primary care doctor, I would go talk to that doctor about the risks and benefits of getting vaccinated.
Great. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Okay, we have about 2 minutes left. Unless we have more hands raised, you can give us some final thoughts and what you think our future actually does look like from an objective viewpoint about our healthcare.
Well, I'm not sure I'm objective, and I don't want to leave it on a horrible note. I mean, I think anybody who's looking at what's happening today should be very concerned that people who are disadvantaged in our community, and I include the visually impaired population in that, should be very worried about what's going to happen over the next year or two. On the other hand, as one of the callers pointed out, we are not powerless. We can call our senators. We can protest. We can vote. There are things that we can do to make our voices known. We can look to established sources of information. So for vaccines and other things, I would go to the Infectious Diseases Society of America or the Society of Healthcare and Epidemiology of America or the American Academy of Pediatrics, these big groups that are made up of physicians and other experts in the field. That's where I would get my information from right now. And I would, I used to say CDC. I don't say you shouldn't go to the CDC website, cdc.gov, but I think you should be very careful what you read there because some of the stuff that's there is not full information. So there are things we can do, but things are, I would say, grimmer today than they've been for years in healthcare.
Doctor, and this is totally up to you, but I would welcome your story next time if we bring you back about, you know, you, as I understand your story, you lost your vision, later in life.
Yeah.
And I think it would be interesting folks to hear that story. I mean, how you made that transition and what that was like, if that's something you'd be willing to share on a future broadcast.
Yes, I would be.
Okay. Terrific.
Yes. And thank you.
We'll figure that out.
Yeah. Okay. Sounds good.
We'll talk privately, Dr. Wyman, and we'll definitely have you back in the near future. We always appreciate having you. You are a wealth of knowledge. We're learning a lot from you and a lot about our healthcare system and other related information pertaining to our health. Thank you for taking the time once again to be with us on In Perspective, Dr. Wyman.
Thank you for the invitation. I really appreciate it. And I love your audience and I really appreciate what you guys are doing with this podcast.
Thank you very much. Go safe with God's abundant blessings, everyone. I'm Bob Branko. Take care.